Welcome to the Delmarva Almanac. Each week, we connect you to the best of Delmarva. I'm your host, Dana Kester McCabe. This week, we'll meet Stevensville painter and sculptor Will Hemsley. We'll hear part one of our story about local genealogy. And we'll hear some birding basics from naturalist Jim Rapp. Will Hemsley has creativity and the life of an Eastern Shore waterman in his blood, quite literally. He comes from a family of boat captains and has his own captain's license. His father runs a fishing charter and is an accomplished painter and sculptor. His mother and sister are also artisans. Will got his training as an oil painter at St. Mary's College in Southern Maryland. He learned to sculpt watching his dad. He is also passing that tradition on to his own young children.
I work from home a lot because I have a studio attached to the house, and my son's always peeking his head in. You know, Dad, come in and play Legos with me and everything like that. And you're always thinking when it's a hand-to-mouth existence like the arts are, I really got to finish this painting. But the back of your head is always lurking. You know, you're going to blink. He's going to be 18. He's not going to want to play Legos with you anymore. So growing up as a kid, my favorite thing to do was to play on the floor of the studio in the winter. You'd have a fire in the fireplace. And just watching the act of my father mix oil paint and seeing all those colors, it was kind of equated to walking into a candy shop. And you see it happen. I want to provide that same experience for my children. And I think it's an empowering experience. And I want them to be able to say, despite what everyone tells you about the arts, it's totally possible. Here's a template.
Last year, Will collaborated with his father on a commissioned sculpture to honor the late Major General Harold Green.
You might remember in the news last year, it was a 4-star general killed in an insider attack in Afghanistan at a NATO base. And he's the highest ranking casualty since Vietnam. And there's a contractor that I do work, like paintings for their lobbies and stuff. And they said, they just got a big contract for some buildings up at Aberdeen. And they had said, this guy's a really important figure in the Aberdeen family, Major General Harold Green. And he's touched so many lives of the people who do business there and who are on the base. We want to do something to recognize him. So I put forward a couple proposals. I mean, my father built this big sculpture there now. And the concept is Fallen Star. And it's basically the star on the general's lapel. But we just kind of made it big enough and imposing enough that it looked like it just fell out of the sky and landed in the ground and kind of embedded itself. And we just finished up that, and it went over so well, they want to do something now for the Gold Star Mothers in the same spot. And if you're unfamiliar with that organization, it's mothers who have lost a son or daughter in war or in service to the military and service to the nation. So I'll be working on a life-size figure in bronze now, who's going to be seated on the bench that's looking at the big Fallen Star sculpture, kind of in reflection.
If you've just joined us, you're listening to the Delmarva Almanac. I'm Dana Kester McCabe, and we're talking to artist Will Hemsley. Will's paintings are done mostly for sale in galleries. His sculptures, which are done in bronze, are often commissions. He describes his approach to these two very different mediums.
My style, I would say it's American realism. But the colors have some, in the application, kind of have an expressionist boldness to them. I started painting very tight, like all painters start to do, and I've since just kind of loosened up. But I'm very much into to that lonely American aesthetic, that Hopper captured so perfectly. Just the play of light on the eaves of buildings, the luminosity of boats at sunset, little things like that, nuances. And I just do my best to capture them. But yeah, I would say it's mostly American realism. When you're sculpting, you're a wrestler. It's very direct. You put your fist into a piece of clay, it's going to have impact. Painting, you're like an illusionist. You're a magician. You're trying to create a trickery with light to create the illusion of something. So I really enjoy the direct nature of sculpture, knowing when I stick my thumb in that, it's going to leave an imprint.
You might say that Will's work is a love song to a magical place that will not be here much longer.
What I really like to do is I'm really enamored with these little pockets on the Eastern Shore that are totally undiscovered, like Crapo or Wingate. Places like that, you go through Blackwater National Refuge and you end up in these little towns that are forgotten by time totally, but you just get the sense of that they were once vibrant places when there was an industry around it, you know, work in the water and things like that. But there's just this sad little beauty about these places. So I come back, I do some sketches, take some photographs, but ultimately when I'm in the studio, I can invent my mood. I can invent the surroundings and the emotion. So I kind of prefer a day on site, do some sketches, maybe a quick painting, go back in the studio and just really kind of dive in. I just finished up a piece, Pound Net Scene. John Lazant, he was an old pound netter down off Bloody Point, and he used to carry a crew of women out there who were every bit as tough as anybody else on the water. I've seen him pull up big old turtles out of the bay and everything. But you know, I'd sit there and do sketches of the process on the pound net, and it's very much a spiritual experience. You know, the sun is just cresting up behind Ken Island, and they're silhouetted, and it's just the majesty of being on the bay right at daybreak is indescribable. I mean, that experience to me is every bit as spiritual as any you can imagine. So I try and convey that in my work, and my work is very much too, you know, I don't shy away from the bones and the blood of it. You know, I want the physical nature of what I'm describing. I want that house that's sunken in the marsh to feel like it's soggy and falling apart. I want those people that are pulling the fish out of the net. You know, I want their muscles tensile. But I want to show, you know, the light to convey the sense of spirituality that I feel when I'm right in front of them. And I hope that comes through in the work. I'm portraying scenes on the Eastern Shore, namely, which is somewhat ironic because most of my clientele and my patronage is based out of Washington, D.C., Baltimore, Philadelphia, Virginia. And I don't sell a lot on the Eastern Shore, but they all want what we have over here hanging on their walls over there, which is kind of neat. I'll just say this about the art. As much as I want it to appeal to you know, the intellectual element of the gallery scene and people coming in and saying, oh, this is a really unique take on this, I want the fella who's hunting the duck blind or the old blacksmith who's working on repairing the oyster rig for the fella who's in disrepair, I want them both to realize it as an authentic experience. So if I can get the blacksmith to appreciate it as much as the gallery patron, I've done something successful. And I try and do that in my painting, and I try and do that in my sculpture as much as I can.
Get links to Will's website and see slides of his work at our website. That's delmarvaalmanac.com/arts. Will's hometown, Stevensville, is a charming place. It's located on Kent Island, the largest island in the Chesapeake Bay. While you're there, visit the Stevensville Train Depot and historic Christ Church. And be sure to get a bite to eat at the Ram's Head Shore House or something sweet at Piece of Cake or Chesapeake Chocolates. There'll be an opening reception for a photography exhibit July 14th from 5 to 7 p.m. at the Kent Island Federation of the Arts on Main Street in Stevensville. This show will run through the end of August. Find links and details for this and other cultural events on our website, delmarvaalmanac.com/arts. The Delmarva Almanac is brought to you in part by the following towns where the arts are flourishing. In Maryland, visit Centerville, Denton, Ocean City, Princess Anne, and Stevensville. And in Delaware, visit Dover, Milford, and Rehoboth Beach. Visit our website for links to their galleries, eateries, and arts-related events. That's delmarvaalmanac.com/artstowns. Genealogy is becoming more and more popular with television shows and online subscription services like Ancestry.com. My father-in-law, Vernon McCabe, had only a passing interest in history when some family business led him to a lifelong fascination with genealogy. His sister had already been bitten by the genealogy bug and had been trying to get him interested in their family tree, which went back many generations right here on Delmarva. When their father passed away and some of the property he bequeathed to them did not have a clear title, Vernon decided to research the land's provenance himself. This revealed some interesting family and local history, and he was hooked. Now, this was 30 years ago when the personal computer was just starting to become available to the general public. Vernon visited local libraries, county land patent offices, historical archives, and attended family reunions. And he began simply calling people in the phone book with the last names he found on his family tree. The focus of his research became one John McCabe, the earliest person in this country with that family name that he could trace back in his own line. But unlike many genealogists, he was not simply interested in going backwards. He wanted to find all the other people who were descended from John McCabe. He has compiled a book now in its third edition with over 47,000 names of his McCabe cousins. He's also compiled a book of relatives on his mother's side, the Quillens. It's not surprising that he found that he was related to many people here on Delmarva. But he also found that he had relatives with diverse ethnic backgrounds beyond what he knew to be his own white Scots-Irish heritage. Vernon McCabe grew up in Ocean View, Delaware, and has lived most of his life in West Ocean City. I recently visited him and asked him to share some of his experiences searching for his family. Here is Vernon McCabe.
I'm glad I got started, and I thank my sister. Oh, that's, by the way, that's Emma Grace McCool from Elkton, Maryland. After all those years of trying to get me interested, she finally did. And I'm glad because I've had a lot of time after I finished serious work, employment on my hands. And if I had not had genealogy, I don't know what I would have done with my time. Well, I did spend a lot of time going backwards. I got back to Charlemagne, and even before that, Alexander the Great. And I mean, all the big names you can think of, I had, and I was descended from all of them. Anyway, I had a pretty big chart going back many, many, many generations. And then my sister informed me that one of our ancestors that I was in the chain going backwards didn't have any children. So all of those nice ancestors were gone. I had to wipe them out. I decided that if I start with the one furthest back and got all of the descendants, that more people would be interested because they could place relationships with all of their cousins. And there might be more interest involved. And I think that's the way it's turned out. I think it has. Half of Sussex County and Worcester County are probably in that McCabe and Quillen book. And it's very common to go out and start hearing about genealogy. And somebody will say, "Are you in the book? Are you in the book?" Well, everybody knows what the book is. And they all take some interest in being cousins to someone else that would otherwise be strangers. I was sitting in my office on a Sunday afternoon, and I thought, okay, I'll start. And I looked up a number, and probably somewhere in Worcester County, and said, "Mrs. Smith, my name is Vernon McCabe, and I'm trying to do the family tree, and I'm hoping you can help me. What do you want, son?" And I said, "Well, I'm trying to figure out who your father and mother were and your kids and put it all in the computer." And she said, "Son, I don't think I'm going to tell you a damn thing," and hung up on me. But since that time, I never had anybody else hang up on me. They all were tickled to death to be included, and I think that's where it got out that they were in the book. You asked me about would people talk to me when I called them. Well, not only would they talk to me, we're no longer strangers, even if we only met on the telephone. I never had anyone give me a bad check for a book. And I know that the McCabes have just as many ornery people as any other clan does. But when you're cousins, you don't give bad checks. I was in physical therapy one time and got to know all the people there over a couple months period. And they found I did genealogy and asked if I would help them with hers, and a couple I did help. Of course, everybody in there, we started calling cousins. There was a black guy in there who had already done his family tree, so he and I got a big kick out of calling each other cousin. And there was a little black girl in there. She wasn't a girl. She was mid-20s or something like that. Very quiet, demure. And one day she came up to me and she said, would you do mine? And I said, well, Cassie, I've never done any black genealogy. And you say you're from Virginia, Eastern Shore. She said, yes. I said, and your parents, did they come from slaves? And she said, yes. I said, well, I'll try. She had to go home and get some people that were born before 1940 so that I could look up on the census. And but the next time she came in, she gave me the list, and then I went back. And the next day I came back and said, Cassie, of course everybody's listening. I said, Cassie, guess what? I said, you and I are cousins. And she said, what? I said, yeah, we're cousins. You go back to the Scarboroughs, and I'm descended from the Scarboroughs, and there was a female who was on the plantation, and apparently she took in a field hand, and they ended up having four kids. They were listed in the census, and it gave their name as the field hand's last name, and she claimed them as her own kids. I said, but we both come from the Scarboroughs, is what it was. Well, the nice part about it was that here this demure little girl came out of herself and she started to talk to people, started calling me cousin, calling everybody else cousin, and I feel like all the 35 years I've been working on it was worth it, just that one thing.
Next week, we'll hear the conclusion of this interview when Vernon McCabe will tell us about his search for the parents of his ancestor, John McCabe. And now for some Delmarva dates with history for this time period. July 1st, 1776, Caesar Rodney made his heroic overnight ride from Dover to Philadelphia to cast the vote that put Delaware on the side of independence from Britain. The colonies had already begun to organize their forces, and on that same day, the USS Delaware was launched to protect ports along the Delaware River. And on Independence Day in 1875, the Atlantic Hotel had its grand opening in Ocean City. It's time for a break now. When we come back, we'll hear some birding basics from naturalist Jim Rapp. Did you know that according to the USDA, 14% of American households did not have a sufficient quantity of affordable, nutritious food for at least part of 2014? Please consider giving generously to your local food bank regularly throughout the year. Visit our website for links for your state, delmarvaalmanac.com/hunger. Welcome back to the Delmarva Almanac. Now here's naturalist Jim Rapp to tell us about the basics of birding and the Seth Demonstration Forest near Easton.
You can find birds anywhere in Delmarva, and getting to know the birds in a familiar local park is a great place to start. In the Easton area, one of the best places to bird is located about 3 miles southeast of town on Dover Neck Road. The Seth Demonstration Forest is a 125-acre tract of loblolly pine and hardwood trees where visitors can hike and observe wildlife. The forest is open every day, year-round, sunrise to sunset. There are no restrooms or facilities other than a small parking area and nature trails for hiking and birding. It has been said that golf is a good walk spoiled. Well, birding just makes a good hike even better. It's like hunting or fishing without the hooks and bullets. Just like hunting and fishing, you'll need some basic equipment and tips to get started on your birding adventure. The most essential piece of equipment a birder owns is a good pair of binoculars. Many brands and different levels of magnification are available, and you can spend $50 to more than $2,000 on binoculars. When purchasing binoculars, first decide on what you want to spend. Low-cost binoculars will be functional, but won't provide the clarity, bright colors, and durability over the higher-priced optics. Binoculars will have numbers attached to them, such as 7x35 or 8x42. The first number refers to the magnification, or how many times closer an object will appear compared to looking with the naked eye. The second number indicates the diameter of the objective lens in millimeters. The objective lens is the one that gathers light. When choosing the magnification power of your binoculars, consider this trade-off. Low magnification binoculars offer a wide field of view and are easy to hold steady. Higher magnification offers a closer, more focused view, but can be difficult to hold steady using your hands alone. For most birders, binoculars with 7 or 8 power work best in the field. This will provide good magnification while still allowing a wide enough look that the birds won't be constantly hopping out of view. If you want to get really good looks at shorebirds on distant mudflats or ducks on the bay, you'll want to invest in a spotting scope. These optics will give you 20 times to 60 times magnification, but will require a tripod for stabilization. Spotting scopes aren't cheap. A good one can cost more than $2,000. Photographing birds can help you remember what you've observed in the field or share your sightings with others. While buying both a good camera and spotting scope may break your budget, you can purchase inexpensive brackets that can connect your smartphone or small digital camera to your scope. Digiscoping is the practice of shooting digital photos through a spotting scope. The scope replaces the heavy telephoto lens of the camera and can take photographs with amazing clarity and brightness. There are many opportunities to learn about the birds before you take your first field trip outdoors. Historically, books have been the birders' best tools for information. Roger Torrey Peterson published the first modern field guide in 1934. Peterson's Guide to the Birds has been updated many times since then and is still available today. Other notable birders, such as David Sibley, Ken Kaufman, and Richard Crossley, have developed their own field guides. Most are small enough that they can be carried with you in a small backpack. More opportunities exist online for advancing your knowledge of birds. One of the best websites for learning about birds and birding is allaboutbirds.org, which is hosted by the Cornell Lab of Ornithology. This website features field guides, bird songs and calls, tips for better birding, and quizzes to test your knowledge. eBird.org is another modern tool used by birders. eBird is a real-time online checklist program that has revolutionized the way that birders report and access information. Launched in 2002 by the Cornell Lab and the National Audubon Society, eBird's goal is to utilize the vast numbers of bird observations made each year by birders. The data collected and entered into eBird by thousands of birders contributes to the science and conservation of birds around the globe. Participating in eBird is easy and free. You create an online account and begin logging your sightings by species and numbers of individuals observed at specific locations. Keeping records has always been a tool used by birders to recall what species and behaviors they've observed in the field. eBird provides an online template for maintaining and sharing your records. Technology can be used in the field, too, thanks to smartphone apps. Apps exist for most modern field guides, and they combine images, range maps, written descriptions, and sound for helping you identify birds by sight and song. eBird has an app for keeping your records in the field, too. The use of bird recordings in the field requires birders to be responsible for their own behavior. playing a recording of a warbler song or owl hoot can lure a wild bird in to investigate a perceived intruder. If this practice is abused, it can be disruptive to the wild bird's behavior. The American Birding Association, which is based in Delaware City, just north of the C&D Canal, has a code of ethics which includes this statement. Limit the use of recordings and other methods of attracting birds, and never use such methods in heavily birded areas or for attracting any species that is threatened, endangered, or of special concern, or is rare in your local area. Once you've got your equipment and technology together, it's time to plan a field trip. Just like any outdoor adventure, watch the weather forecast and plan for exploring in habitat that might include ticks and chiggers. Wear comfortable clothing and the proper footwear for hiking on high forest ground or muddy trails near the marsh. Don't forget other outdoor basics too, such as sunscreen and a bottle of water. The Seth Demonstration Forest in Easton is a great place to launch a beginning birding adventure. 88 species have been recorded here on eBird.org, including common year-round birds such as red-bellied woodpecker, blue jay, and Carolina chickadee, and neotropical migrants such as black-throated green warbler, scarlet tanager, and Acadian flycatcher. The best time of day to observe forest birds is early morning, right after sunrise. Once you're outside, try practicing a four-step approach to identifying the birds. First, consider the habitat you're exploring. You're much more likely to find wrens and warblers in the Seth Demonstration Forest in May than you will shorebirds and swans. Second, judge the bird's size and shape to help you distinguish an ovenbird from an owl. You'll be surprised at how much this can help narrow down the species you're observing. Third, look for its main colors and feather patterns. Finally, take note of its behavior. A bird climbing vertically on a tree trunk is likely a woodpecker or nuthatch rather than a robin or sparrow. Birding can be enjoyed alone or with friends. If you want to make connections with other birders, look into joining your local bird club. Delmarva also features several birding festivals. Visit www.delmarvabirding.com to learn more about birding events on the peninsula. If you enjoy sharing your sightings with others through social media, check out the Regional Birding Facebook pages. Search Facebook for MD Birding, Delaware Birding, and Birding Virginia to see what others are seeing on Delmarva. Until next time, I hope this story inspires you to start birding and explore Delmarva's many natural wonders.
Thanks, Jim. Find links to the websites Jim mentioned and others to learn more about birding on our website, delmarvaalmanac.com/nature. Well, that's all for this edition of the Delmarva Almanac. Be sure to follow us on Facebook or Twitter, and next week join us to learn more about our local culture and get connected to our natural wonders. We'd like to thank our community partners, the Friends of Delmarva Public Radio, and our underwriters for their help in bringing this program to you, our audience. Our theme music was provided by Brightside Studio. This show has been a Moonshell production. Thanks for listening. We hope you enjoy your Independence Day weekend. Until we meet again, may the rhythms and tides of Delmarva bring you good fortune.